Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
You are listening to Perplexity.
Today we will be exploring one of the most famous mysteries of all time. On January 25th, 1959, a group of 10 Russian students, all experienced hikers, would head to Mount Atortin in the northern Ural Mountains of Russia for a 16-day exploration. The trip had been organized by a hiking team of the Ural Polytechnic Institute, and they were sent out on an approved route. Just over 1 week into their excursion, 9 hikers would all die mysteriously. This mystery has led to countless theories, ranging from the supernatural to foul play, and even government cover-up. This is the perplexing story of the Dyatlov Pass incident. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Kadra. If you are new to the show, hello and welcome. I tell tales every single week that have perplexed me. So if you love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more, don't worry, you're in the right place. And if you end up enjoying the way this story was told today, I would love if you continue to follow along. If you are a returning listener, hello, my friends. Welcome back. I'm happy you're here. We have a huge episode today, and this is probably something I could make into multiple parts. It's just one of those rabbit holes you could go down forever. So I'm not going to do that. I'm still going to give you tons and tons of info. Many of you have requested this. Most recently, Patrick and Grayson recommended that I talk about this, but I know I've heard from many more of you. And I'm really just very, very disturbed and perplexed by this story. So we are going to get into that in just a second. I just wanted to remind everybody really quickly that the first weekend of September, I am going to be at CrimeCon in Denver. So anybody going to CrimeCon, I would love to see you. Or if you just are in the Denver area, if you want to do like a listener meetup or anything, let me know. I would love to see you guys. I also just wanted to say that today's story has a lot of similarities to the Yuba County 5 case, which I did a really, really deep dive on, 3 parts, quite a while ago, and that has also been known as the American Dyatlov Pass incident. I think back then I called it Dilatov, so apologies. I have been practicing the pronunciation, and it seems like it is Dyatlov, so I'm sorry. If I'm not saying that right, I know it's not Dilatov, so sorry for saying that wrong like a year ago. But there are a lot of similarities. So with that being said, if you like this story, I don't mean that in like a morbid way, but you would probably like listening to the Yuba County 5 episodes that I did as well. Trigger warning for today's episode. This is going to be pretty heavy and disturbing, so listener discretion is advised. And all the sources that I use for today's episode will be down in the show notes. So without further ado, let's get into this huge mystery, the story of the Dyatlov Pass incident. Our story begins on January 23, 1959, when a group of 10 students in their early 20s, 8 men and 2 women, headed out to the Ural Mountains. The hikers were 23-year-old Igor Dyatlov, 21-year-old Yuri Doroshenko, 20-year-old Lyudmila Dubinia, a female, 23-year-old Krivonishenko, 24-year-old Alexander Kolovadov, 22-year-old Zenaida Kolmogorova, female, 23-year-old Rustem Slobodin, 23-year-old Nikolai Fibo-Brignolis, and 38-year-old Semyon Alexander Zolotaryov. There was also a 21-year-old man named Yuri Yudin, but he would leave early due to injury. And I apologize if I said any of those names wrong. Trying my best. So the goal was that these hikers would pass their level 3 mountaineering test, meaning these hikers were already very experienced and prepared. This was funded through their university, so they had all the supplies they needed, they had cameras, they'd already mapped out a route, and this was going to be through the Ural Mountains, which were very snowy and large, and there were a lot of steep areas. It would be a 215-mile round trip. First, the hikers would take train number 45 from Sverdlovsk to the city of Sarov. One of their diaries mentioned that they took train number 43, but there was no number 43 train, so investigators believe they took train number 45. They hid beneath the seats to avoid paying for tickets, which is like classic early 20s behavior. And the next morning, the group would arrive at Sarov. One of the hikers, Krivonishenko, was detained for soliciting and singing. He was later released, but there was some type of confrontation with him and a drunk local that accused him of stealing his vodka. But this is the only known confrontation that occurred in the group. And this was long before the events that would unfold in the mountains. On January 25th, the group took train number 81 in Ivdel and then a bus to Vizhay. The students then started their excursion to the mountains. On the 26th of January, they took a truck to District 41, which was like this logging area. And then the next day, they took a sled to an abandoned mining settlement. This is really just to show you guys how rural this area was. It is not easy to get to, which means it would also be hard to get someone out there for rescue. Like I mentioned earlier, one of the hikers, Yuri Yudin, would leave because of injury. He left on the 28th of January, and I got varying reports on this, but it seems like the general consensus was he was in a lot of pain, whether it be from his knee or from his sciatica or whatever. But he wasn't able to hike, so he left. And then on January 29th, the remaining 9 hikers would go from Lazva to Ospia River on skis and stay the night. January 30th and 31st, the group would pitch their tents on the Ospia River. On February 1st, the group then dropped a cache of extra food for their trip back, burying the food in a hole in the snow, which indicates that they had plans to return back. They made this decision as a group. The next day, February 2nd, the group would all die mysteriously. 10 days then went by, and on February 12th, a search was finally launched. But this took a while because the group sponsoring their trip did have a protocol, like if they didn't hear back from a certain time, they would bring a group of people out to find them. But again, it took a while to get to this area because it was so remote. And basically, the way that they knew something was wrong is because one of the hikers was supposed to send a telegram, and that telegram never came. They also never reached their next checkpoint. So a rescue team slash search party would go out, but they wouldn't arrive until February 21st. It then took another 5 days to find where the hikers had been camping. So on February 26th, this rescue party finally came across the group's canvas tents. And they were immediately confused by where these tents were. They were very tiny and, you know, not like super sturdy tents, so they thought it was strange that these experienced mountaineers would put their tents on the windswept side of this icy mountain situated in the middle of the slope. Strategically, this is like one of the worst places to put these tents. So that makes me think that they put these tents there in a hurry, and they kind of didn't have a choice Or maybe there was like a blizzard and they couldn't really see where they were putting their tents. They just tried to get cover. The hikers were nowhere to be seen, though. Their tents were empty. And their clothing was neatly folded inside of the tents. Their tents had also been slashed open with a knife from the inside. So based on these concerning findings and there being no sign of these hikers, an official investigation was launched this same day. The next thing that the rescuers noticed were footprints, leading from the canvas tents down the icy slope. It was clear these footprints were from a group of 9 people. But one of the things that was really unsettling is that all of these footprints were either barefoot, they may have been wearing socks, or just wearing one shoe. Eventually, the footprints faded, and then on the edge of the woods, on the opposite side of the pass, they found the first 2 bodies. These 2 bodies were underneath a large cedar tree, and this was Krivonoshenko and Doroshenko. And both of these victims were only wearing underwear. They were lying near a burned-out fire as well, so it seemed like they had been trying to keep warm. But again, they're only wearing underwear. The branches of the nearby cedar tree had also been broken up to 5 meters high, suggesting that the hikers had tried to climb up this tree to look for something or to hide from someone. According to some sources, one of the hikers was actually found up in the tree. And it's also possible they were going up into this tree to escape something because deep gouges that could not have come from a human were found in one of the trees. Doroshenko also had skin that was brownish purple, and a mysterious gray foamy liquid was coming out of his mouth. Trigger warning. One of the most disturbing details that really sticks with me is Krivonoshenko had a chunk of human flesh in his mouth. And then he also had a chunk of flesh missing from his hand, which would indicate that he had bitten off part of his own hand. About 1 mile away were 3 more bodies. The bodies of Dyatlov, Slobodin, and Kolmogorova. These bodies were all found in a cave, and it appeared that they had been trying to go back towards their campsite. It would later be determined that these 5 students had all passed away from hypothermia. This was the harshest time of year in the Ural Mountains. This area would have been in the negative temperatures, somewhere between negative 13 and negative 22 degrees Fahrenheit, or negative 25 to negative 30 degrees Celsius. And the wind gusts would have been brutal, up to 60 miles an hour. Slobodin also had multiple areas of edema and abrasions on his face and arms and a small crack in his skull, but this was not thought to be fatal. These hikers had also clearly been exchanging clothing. Some of the hikers were wearing men's clothing and other hikers were wearing the women's clothing, and it was later determined that many of the people found in this cave were wearing the clothing of their deceased friends found further back from the cedar tree, which would indicate they didn't all die at the same time. It would take more than 2 months to find the other 4 hikers. They were buried under 13 feet of snow in a heavily forested ravine. And this is where it gets even more disturbing. 3 of the 4 victims had fatal injuries. Thibaut Brignoles, Dubinia, and Zolotarov. Kolovatov was found beside them, and his eyebrows were noted to be missing. But his cause of death was hypothermia. Thibaut Brignoles had died from a skull injury with multiple fractures to the side of his skull, consistent with falling and tumbling multiple times. Dubinia and Zolotaryov had severe chest fractures. In fact, one of them had such a severe chest injury that they were described as their chest basically being caved in. It was as if a speeding car had run straight into them. Dubinia also had internal bleeding and was missing some of her body parts. her eyeballs were missing, part of her face and lips, tongue, and a fragment of her skull. Zolotaryov was also missing his eyeballs. And there are some sources that say that these body parts that were missing, it looked like they had been cut out with extreme precision.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This didn't seem like it was the work of animals. It also appeared that these injuries happened post-mortem. There was nothing around to explain these injuries either. There was no blood. There was no sign of a vehicle. Not that a vehicle could even get into this area. There was no sign of an explosion or a struggle. Other people having been there, there were no animal tracks. It was incredibly eerie and disturbing. There was a doctor who was a part of the official inquest into these deaths, and this is Dr. Boris Vozrozdeny. He determined that these four students that were found months later had, quote, died from an unknown compelling force. So one of the biggest questions is, what the hell does that mean? And also, why did these hikers leave their tent? Why did they leave their tents with little to no clothing on in sub-freezing temperatures? It just doesn't make any sense. Initially, a nearby Mansi tribe had been accused of attacking the group for being on their land, but this was a very peaceful group and they were exonerated. But this doctor makes this conclusion that they were killed by this unknown compelling force, and then all of a sudden, the case was closed in May of 1959 with no definitive conclusions, leaving these loved ones distraught and, I'm sure, very pissed off. And that's really all that we have in terms of what we know, the facts. So let's get into some theories, and that is going to take up the bulk of this episode. So get ready to speculate wildly, because that's about all that we can do, unfortunately. And it's so tragic because these were like able-bodied, minded, very driven, clearly very smart young people who had so much life ahead of them. And there's all these loved ones that were left behind and we still don't know what happened. So with all that being said, all we can do respectfully is speculate. There have been countless theories as well. So I want to emphasize that because I'm sure there's going to be some things that we don't touch on today. But these theories range from extreme weather phenomenon to the supernatural. So first, there are some different theories with weather. One of the theories is that it was some type of ball lightning that took out the hikers. This could have possibly caused some type of little avalanche, like maybe it was a cascade of things. If someone was struck by lightning, that could explain the burns that some of them were found with, which we'll talk about more in some of the other theories, but some of them were found with very significant burns on them. Like one of them we mentioned had his eyebrow singed. Another one I kept finding a lot was katabatic wind, which I had never heard of. But katabatic winds sound absolutely terrifying, and I'm just gonna read this straight from Wikipedia. A katabatic wind is a downslope wind caused by the flow of an elevated high-density air mass into a lower-density air mass below under the force of gravity. Since air density is strongly dependent on temperature, the high-density air mass is usually cooler, and the katabatic winds are relatively cool or cold. So basically, because of these compelling forces with gravity and temperature, it creates this sudden gust of wind. Katabatic winds have been reported in areas like Antarctica and Greenland, so perhaps that is a crazy weather phenomenon that happened here and caused at least some of the deaths. But it doesn't explain everything. None of these theories do. That's part of the problem. It's like none of them fully explain what happened. One of the other theories that I came across a lot that seems to have a little bit more weight to it is the theory of an avalanche. There are some holes with that theory, though, so let's get into that a little bit. There were no obvious signs of an avalanche. Avalanches cause a bunch of snow to be dislodged, and this was not found. Now, granted, it took a while to find everybody, but this is a very remote area that people aren't really coming across. So the snow, it would take a long time for it to get more like in a fixed, dense position again. The area that the hikers were found also had no history of avalanches. So you might be wondering how this theory has any weight to it. But stay with me. Avalanches can only occur if the snow sitting on a slope is steeper than 30 degrees. The slope where the hikers were, upon initial investigation, did not seem like it was that steep. And the hiker's cause of death doesn't fully fit the avalanche theory because avalanche victims very rarely die from blunt force trauma. They actually suffocate. And there was no cause of death with any of the victims that was suffocation. But four of the hikers had blunt force trauma. There are, though, some things that come up later that we'll get into at the end that talk about avalanches more, where it kind of kept my mind open to that theory. So we'll come back to that. Some other theories have been that at least some of the deaths were from an animal. Some people have said a reindeer or a wolverine or a bear, a yeti, but I don't really think that makes any sense. The only thing that I thought is like maybe something ate some of the victims' body parts after death and that quote unquote surgical precision was just people getting freaked out and kind of over-exaggerating in reports. But there were those deep gouges in the tree, so maybe some of it had been from animals, or maybe initially someone saw an animal and it frightened them, and that just kind of cascaded this whole series of unfortunate events. There's also been some theories thrown around that this was some type of weird anomaly, like a fluctuation in gravity, or something called infrasound. And the theory of infrasound is that it's basically this noise created by wind traveling around a mountain. There's also been some theories that this started as some type of accident, like maybe they were cooking inside on the stove and there was some type of fire, so they had to force their way out of the tent as the fire spread. There have been some reports that there were signs of a fire. Some of the members of the group were found with singed hands, but again, this could be just because they were trying to keep warm. And additionally, when the investigators were looking at the footprints, they didn't seem erratic. That's one of the other kind of eerie things about this case, is that the investigators could tell if the footprints were like hastily moving about from the tent or if they were just walking. The footprints didn't seem erratic. Whatever initially caused them to leave their tents, they left calmly. And I think that's more disturbing. I don't know. There have been other theories thrown around like methanol poisoning, shrooms, doping, golden root, Arctic hysteria. There's just so many. There's paranormal theories, like some type of time vortex or a UFO. There's also foul play theories. Had someone in the group done something? Had there been some type of attack from somebody? But that doesn't explain the chest fractures, I don't think. And there's no signs of foul play. So I don't think that any of that makes any sense. For me, I go back and forth between two things. some type of micro avalanche, which we'll talk about more, or some type of military experiment gone wrong. That's one of the biggest, most upsetting theories in this whole case. There are theories of the KGB or special forces being involved in these deaths, and there are records of parachute mines being tested by the military in this area, which would detonate before they would hit the ground. So that could cause a massive explosion and perhaps a lot of wind, and that could trigger some type of weather event. The military had no idea, allegedly, that these hikers were in the area, and they had been running this exercise about 15 to 20 miles away. So suppose that the group calmly came out of their tents because they heard a loud explosion of a parachute mine. This could have also caused them to quickly cut away from their tents and just step outside, and then maybe they didn't hear the explosion again. So they're just calmly walking around, trying to figure out what it is. Maybe something else went wrong where they had to seek immediate shelter and they didn't have time to get dressed. They also might have been in a hurry just trying to find a more sturdy area to seek shelter because their canvas tents are not very secure. My mind is also thinking, like, if I heard an explosion, I might try to go find a cave, like some of the other hikers did. A group of hikers 30 miles away did report seeing glowing orange orbs in the sky around the area where the Dyatlov group had been camping, which also could be UFOs, or it could be, like I said, the parachute mines. The chief investigator, Lev Ivanov, commented in 1990, quote, "I suspected at the time, and I am almost sure that these bright flying spheres had a direct connection to their deaths," end quote. Similar spheres were observed in Ivdel and other nearby areas from February to March 1959 by various independent witnesses, including professionals, like people that worked in meteorology and in the military. And all these people did not know what they were looking at. They were calling in and reporting it. These sightings freaked out these professionals so much that some of them thought they were being invaded by another country. They were reporting this to their higher-ups, and they weren't getting any answers. Some of the hikers were also found to have a surprisingly high level of radiation on their clothing, and five of the group members had unusually tanned faces, which was reported by loved ones who attended some of the hikers' funerals. So the question with that is, was it radiation from a military exercise, or was it some type of UFO phenomenon? Loved ones had no answers and were mourning the loss of these amazing men and women, and then suddenly, the Soviet government came in and said they were shutting everything down. In late May, the investigation was mysteriously and unsettlingly closed, declaring an avalanche had killed the party, and then they confiscated all related documents. Vladimir Korotev was one of the first investigators on the scene in February, and he was unexpectedly fired in the early stages of the investigation. In 1996, Korotev was interviewed, and he reported that the KGB was guarding the morgue when the hikers' autopsies were being done, and that they would not allow anyone inside. He also talked of a very strange encounter that he had with Lev Ivanov, one of the other investigators. So he says about this, quote, "Ivanov came by, but everyone was frightened. That was suspicious too. There were two barrels of spirits there, after each procedure, so to speak. We would descend naked into the barrels of spirits. It made me wonder, what was all this about? Nobody said anything. Well, thoughts arose, what's going on here? At that time, we knew nothing about radiation. And what I've just told you remains unresolved. I even had some Mansi people with me. They were an illiterate people with their own tanga, you see, and they were very good at drawing. There were drawings, something like a rocket. You understand, in 59, we had no idea what a rocket was. There weren't any televisions, or rather, nobody spoke about anything at all, but they drew it. End quote. So obviously there's some really disturbing and weird stuff in that quote. He talks about going naked into a bucket of spirits. I don't really know what that's about, but from what I'm gathering, they are trying to not get their clothing contaminated. So they're going into these buckets and like observing the remains. I don't know. It's really, really weird. And him calling them spirits makes it even more like spooky to me. And then when he's talking about the Mansi people, that's the tribe that lived there. So they were also seeing some weird shit in the sky. And they drew something that resembled a rocket, but this was not 1969. This was 1959, when we didn't know what rockets were. So we didn't have that understanding until later, when he's, you know, doing this interview and stuff. But the drawings resembled what we now know as a rocket. And he also found similar drawings in Kolmogorova's diary, one of the hikers. So it seems like there is pretty much clear confirmation that there were weird orange orbs in the sky and something that was a rocket or rocket-like. So I feel like that very clearly points to military testing.
Ready to put a little spin on your day? Then check out Chumba Casino's new online social casino game, Ryan Seacrest 10K Ways. It's free and packed with 10,000 ways to play, only at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
And also, thinking as like someone in their young 20s, if you saw something like that in the sky, that would certainly be frightening and very confusing, and that would definitely make me leave my tent. Korotev, the investigator, would also confirm he issued an order for a forensic medical examination for all of the hikers. But the protocols and the case materials were destroyed, saying, quote, it was a most terrible violation of the law. So this is where he's talking about the Soviet government sweeping in for some weird, unsettling reason and shutting the whole investigation down. He continued to run into roadblocks in the investigation because of this, and he was also constantly being pressured to close the case before it was finally closed. In 2008, six former rescuers and 31 independent experts gathered at a conference in Yekaterinburg, convened by the Ural State Technical University and the Dyatlov Foundation, and they concluded military testing had caused the deaths. But there's still debate. There are other experts that feel this was an avalanche. So I said we were going to go back to the avalanche theory now, and I will say I do think some of this has some weight. So two things could be true. Or none of this could be true. I don't know. Alexander Puzhrin, a geological engineer, learned about the Dyatlov Pass incident in 2019 and quickly grew obsessed. Puzhrin also had the scientific skills to test the avalanche theory, so he's way smarter than me, so we're just going to go with what he says. Puzhrin also found this other scientist to help him out with his research named Johan Gom, and they started running avalanche simulations. They realized that the avalanche theory was stronger than people thought. So remember, initially we thought this theory had no weight because avalanches didn't happen in this area. They have to have a slope of at least 30 degrees, and there was no dislodged snow. There was no suffocation injuries. But beneath the snowy slope of this mountain, there were some areas that had 30 degrees or more of a steep slope. Scientists also started poring over the documents that the hikers had dug down in the snow to form a hollow for their tent. And Soviet officials had examined a cross-section of that snow, and they found a thin layer of rotten ice. So this happens when the ice is exposed to the sun and it melts a little bit. If you get several feet of snow on top of that, then there's no way the hikers would see that, and they wouldn't know that they were camping on unsolid ground. And this could have resulted in the hikers being involved in a slab avalanche, which is much smaller than a typical avalanche. The scientists then tried modeling a slab avalanche on the computer. But something that's really interesting about this, they said it was really complicated because snow physics are really hard to simulate. So one of the scientists, he had actually recently watched the movie Frozen, and he was really impressed by how realistic the snow was. And he reached out to one of the film's animators, and they agreed to hand over the code that they used. So it was with the code from the Frozen movie that these scientists attempted to solve a 60-year mystery. So they start running these simulations, and they determined, based on their results, that the slab avalanche was a promising theory. So if this is what actually happened, the hikers could have been pinned down under 1,000 pounds of crushing weight. And that could explain the blunt force trauma and why the hikers slashed away their tents. The door flaps would have been blocked. But again, no theory explains all of the deaths. What about the other four hikers with the skull and rib fractures? What about the burns and the radiation? Doesn't explain that. The scientists theorized that the victims that had skull and rib fractures, that could have happened because they were digging a shelter and then the shelter collapsed on them. One of the other big mysteries is the fact that avalanches are not known to occur here. So the scientists that were running all of these experiments sent drones over the area to capture aerial footage. And one camera would capture a small slab avalanche. And this would also explain why locals never saw an avalanche here. Slab avalanches are very tiny, the wind covers them up. So all that to say, it is possible for slab avalanches to happen in the area where these students died. So the scientists ultimately concluded that the following events most likely happened. The students got lost in a blizzard. They dug out a hollow for their tent. The hollow was below a hidden steep slope and on top of rotten ice, so the snow released and crushed their tent. The hikers sliced their way out, but several could not retrieve their boots or their coats, and they were probably fearing another avalanche. So they got down the hill as fast as they could. They built a fire to keep warm. Desperate to keep warm, they leaned dangerously close to the fire to the point of scorching their skin, and many would ultimately die of hypothermia. As for why those two were found nearly naked, perhaps their companions removed their clothing afterwards to protect themselves, because like I said, some of them were found with men and women's clothing from earlier. Or it is known that people freezing to death can experience something called paradoxical undressing. It's one of the end stage things of hypothermia where you start to get delusional and you start to feel very hot. So you take off your clothes. A delusional mind could also explain why one hiker bit part of his own hand off. He was going mad, which is absolutely heartbreaking and horrifying to even think about. So perhaps the slab avalanche theory explains some of the deaths. And that would have likely still left a couple of the hikers alive because they were all found in different areas. So the remaining four hikers that were found months later, it seems like they left their dead companions behind, hiked into the woods, and started digging a snow pit for protection. And this included laying down pine branches because there were broken branches found. They perhaps dug over a local stream that never freezes. The stream had hollowed out a tunnel of ice 12 feet below. After they climbed down into the pit, that ice tunnel collapsed and the overlying snow crushed them against the branches. Because remember, they were found several feet under all of the snow and debris. That would be like thousands of pounds of pressure, so that could explain the trauma to their heads and their chests. As for why they were missing parts of their faces, the scientists said that that's likely because they were found lying face down in the stream. Their tissue probably either rotted off or small animals buried down there and were scavenging before the rescue team arrived. So today, most experts agree that this was either an avalanche or this was military testing. So that gives some sense, I guess, of closure for the victims' families, but I still can't help but wonder why the radiation, why the missing body parts, because I don't think that that theory fully explains everything with like the stream. Why the gray foamy liquid coming out of one of the hikers' mouths, you know, it's just, it doesn't make sense. I can't help but wonder if the military testing harmed some of the hikers. To me, that better explains the burns, the tanned skin, and the radiation. And perhaps this testing triggered a slab avalanche that killed some of the other hikers. Understandably, the case of the Dyatlov Pass incident continues to be a big subject of debate, speculation, and there are tons of allegations of government cover-up. It's truly one of the most famous mysteries of all time, and one of those cases that will continue to keep me up at night. So that, everybody, is the perplexing story of the Dyatlov Pass incident. I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. If you did, I would love if you let me know. Drop a comment down below on YouTube, like this video and subscribe, and continue to follow along. If you're listening on Spotify, you can drop a comment in this exact episode letting me know your thoughts. If you haven't done so yet, please, please, please leave a 5-star review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you can. That helps me get more listeners and boosts me up the charts, and that is a free, super quick, easy way to support the show. If you want to support the show further, though, I would not be upset about it, and that means you get early and ad-free episodes, tons of bonus content, and a community, and that is over at The Perplexed Society. So that is patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. Everybody, I love you so much. You all are amazing. I hope you have a great week. Please stay safe, and I will talk to you next week. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Perplexity, a mystery podcast hosted, written, and produced by Kadra Brannon. Assistant producer is TJ McRae. If you enjoyed today's episode, tell the world about it by leaving a 5-star review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It really is the best way to support. Have a topic request or a perplexing story of your own you'd like to share? Send an email to perplexitymysterypodcast@gmail.com. If you would like to support the show further and unlock exclusive bonus content, join the Perplexed Society at patreon.com/perplexitymysterypodcast. Perplexity merch and additional support links can be found in the episode description. Until next week, stay curious.
Hey, it is Ryan Seacrest here. Want to bring a little Hollywood excitement to your day? Take a few spins with Chumba Casino's brand new game, Ryan Seacrest's 10K Ways. It's free and features 10,000 ways to play, giving you nonstop action, including thrilling bonus respins and cascading reels. Every spin brings something new, so step into the spotlight, enjoy the excitement, and play today at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.